So I'm pleased to have been asked to explore this often challenging theme of looking at the connection of our practice with the theme of race and racism. And I have been appreciative, actually, of Vita's question. I think in December of last year, asking me, I don't know if you remember it, but asking me when I was talking about something else, how I responded to some of the events happening. At that time, it was, I think, the second major non-indictment of a police officer, right after the death of a young black man. And and we talked some about that there, but I think I was actually sparked by that, as Art mentioned, to change the topic on the next Wednesday. Originally, I was going to continue looking at the theme of greed, grasping, and craving, which is a venerable and important topic. But I began and gave two talks exploring, so I'm thankful of that. And I also want to say in advance, I'm thankful to my mother, Bernice, who's here, for giving me quite a lot of education in this area, you know, for a long time. In fact, I think it's been an important area for a long time. I grew up in Maryland, near Washington, D.C., and the schools, the public school systems where I lived had been desegregated the year before I began public school. And so I went to elementary school, I think with about 30% African-American students. So probably not typical for so-called white people, right? Mm-hmm. And had that experience. And I think my mom also told me she attended the 1963 March on Washington and wanted me and my brother to come along and gave us a chance to come along, and we had better things to do. So, being on the young side, and but she gave us freedom of choice, right? and then also later, you know, there was very involved with issues of race, was actually in charge of race relations for the entire public school system of Richmond, Virginia for 10 years during a time of forced desegregation, and was, you know, had that title and conducted all sorts of workshops in what we now call diversity training. So it's, as it were, been in the family discussion for a while, these issues. And I've also been kind of newly interested in going further in various ways, and helped, I think I probably was the main initiator, and started a group of white Dharma teachers talking together about race. And we've been having conference calls for over a year, every month. You know, and that's been very, very interesting, and, you know, sharing information and questions and so forth. And as well, I was also part of, recently we had a 6-month program at the East Bay Meditation Center for, again, people identified as white who were interested in working on these issues. It was quite a good program. So, nonetheless, I think it's good to take a deep breath before going into this territory, so I invite you to do that now. It's a charged area. I thought of the phrase, where angels fear to tread. Yeah. It's a challenge. It's a very challenging area, and yet very crucial, and a lot of the recent events seem to have shown that whatever the meaning of having a African-American president or someone who identifies as African-American as president, and clearly certain major changes in the last 50 years, there still are tremendous residues, or very large residues, of issues, and those manifest most directly in these, or most obviously in these killings, in the police killings, and the lack of indictments and so forth. And I actually had the experience right after we had that interchange, I think, or maybe it was the week, right, the few days before, I was invited to be on jury duty in Oakland. I live in Berkeley, and was on jury duty, and there was a young black man charged with a crime, I forget what it was, and I was actually on the prospective jury, and ready to be on the jury, and then the judge and the attorney started dismissing jurors, and they dismissed, the first person dismissed was an African-American woman who said she doubted that young black men could be treated justly. She was gone. There was a Latino woman who was also dismissed, I'm not sure of the reasons. Then there was a young European-American activist who had been, who was working, I think, with a service called the Daily Coast and had been sending people to Ferguson and talked about that. He was dismissed. And then I was questioned, what happens in these trials, potential jury members are questioned, and I talked about having some run-ins with the law, about being arrested. I was arrested for protesting the invasion of Iraq along with Sylvia, actually, and Jack Kornfield, and there was a gathering of so-called religious leaders. And we were held for 3 hours, and then I think someone decided, probably in Washington, they didn't want to bring us to trial. We just said, go home. So I talked about that. I talked about my being held by the, incited by the police for skinny dipping in a Massachusetts reservoir when I was in my 20s. And I talked about some of my views about the justice system, and I was dismissed. But a lot of things really suggest, again, that these issues of race are far from settled, particularly for African Americans, I think, and to some extent for Latinos, but really across the board, but especially thick with African Americans. We know that, just a few statistics, 40% of African American children live in poverty. Some of you know these statistics, they're rather sobering. 1 in 3 African-American men is in the prison system in some way. 1 in 3. Much of that for drug offenses. Whatever we think of drug laws in the first place, it's been very well documented that the drug laws are enforced in a skewed way. I think it's been very well shown that, for example, African-American men are incarcerated for cocaine use at 4 times the rate of white men, even though the statistics show that there's equal amount of use. Right? So you could go on and on like that, right? Some of you know these kind of statistics. Young black men are 21 more times likely to be shot by the police than white men, young white men. Right? Again, complications to some of those, but we know that there is an issue. And we can ask the question, really, what's the relationship of all this to our practice, to our meditation practice? Isn't our meditation practice primarily just about having an inner practice where we become calm, develop some insight, and learn how to live with less suffering and less causing of suffering? Is our practice essentially something we do in private? What's it have to do with these larger social issues? You know, and there are a lot of tendencies, I think, in the way Buddhism is formed in the West, that tend to reinforce that view, right? That our practice is something we do in private, and it's not so connected to these large issues. You know, maybe we become more open-hearted and wiser, and we more compassionate. We want to address these issues, but what's the direct connection with our practice? This is from Bhikkhu Bodhi, some of you know, who has a different view of this. Some of you know Bhikkhu Bodhi is an American-born monk who's the major translator of the Pali Canon. So very dedicated to traditional views. But he's also is a very interesting guy. He has this interest in connecting the practice with social issues. So he said this in an essay in 2007. It seems to me that we Western Buddhists tend to dwell in a cognitive space that defines the First Noble Truth largely against the background of our middle-class lifestyle, lifestyles as the gnawing of discontent, the ennui of oversatiation, the pain of unfulfilling relationships, or with a bout of Buddhist theory as bondage to the round of rebirths. Too often I feel our focus on these aspects of dukkha has made us oblivious to the vast catastrophic suffering that daily overwhelms 3/4 of the world's population. You know, and we might add to other species, to the earth and so forth, right? That there are tendencies where, again, it's not so much because we're not moral persons, but there are does that describe something, tendencies that we can see? And very interesting, one of my favorite passages was from 1964, from Gary Snyder. And he said something very similar, like 50 years ago. He said this actually not so much about Western Buddhism, but about Buddhism in general. He said, historically, Buddhist philosophers have failed to analyze out the degrees to which ignorance and suffering are caused or encouraged by social factors, considering fear and desire to be given facts of the human condition. Consequently, the major concern of Buddhist philosophy is epistemology, which means how we know or how we're ignorant, and psychology, with no attention paid to historical or sociological problems. Although Mahayana Buddhism has a grand vision of universal salvation, the actual achievement of Buddhism has been the development of practical systems of meditation towards the end of liberating a few dedicated individuals. Institutional Buddhism has been conspicuously ready to accept or ignore the inequalities and tyrannies of whatever political system it found itself under. So I think he's primarily talking about Asian Buddhism there. The mercy of the West has been social revolution. The mercy of the East has been individual insight into the basic self, void. We need both. They are both contained in the traditional three aspects of the Dharma path: wisdom, prajna, meditation, dhyana, and morality, sila. Wisdom is intuitive knowledge of the mind of love and clarity that lies beneath one's ego-driven anxieties and aggressions. Meditation is going into the mind to see this for yourself, over and over again until it becomes the mind you live in. Morality is bringing this back out in the way you live through personal example and responsible action, ultimately towards the true community or sangha of all beings. 1964. So there are those tendencies. And from my own perspective, I want to give somewhat of a framework for looking at issues of race, which is, I find that addressing some of our larger social, collective, ecological issues is a very crucial part of awakening in our time. This, we can discuss this. In other words, we can ask this question: what does awakening mean right now in our culture? Does it mean to awaken individually? And I think we can see this pretty clearly with issues of race, but also with other issues, that we, I think, are more and more aware that to awaken means to cut through all the areas of our conditioning, all the areas where there's a shadow, where we're not aware, where we're on automatic, where we don't know, and also, I think, to respond to the suffering of our times. You know, I think this is called for from an ethical point of view. How do we do that? You know, I think we're actually evolving towards what we might call a new map of awakening that includes how we work individually, but how we, in our individual practice as well as our community practice, respond to these larger issues. And I think there's something about what's called for in our times that we need to do that. And I've thought about this in different ways. I've thought of, from the one perspective, there's something that's really called for to both look into one's own conditioning, where one itself is blind, or where there's tendencies towards self-centeredness that are sometimes hidden. That I think we're called to move out of a more self-centered meditation practice. It's very ironic that meditation practice can be in the interest of cutting through self-centeredness, self-centered. And can be actually something where we cultivate our own peace while the world is burning. Right? In fact, when I was spending more time in Asia, and I would go to gatherings of the International Network of Engaged Buddhists, especially in Thailand, a number of the Asian teachers that I met said they feared that Buddhism in the West would be simply the plaything of the middle class in a way that it would be isolating and would kind of help people to adjust better to a crazy world. Right? They had that fear, you know, which has stayed with me. I also heard that meeting liberation theologians from Latin America. Similar concerns about spirituality in the West. So that's the backdrop. I'm going to suggest that there's something that's called for that helps us that calls us really to connect our practice with responding to the needs of the world. And that actually, this is actually how we wake up yet further. There have been plenty of people who've talked about that in the past. I think particularly of Joanna Macy. She has a very, very, some very beautiful language. She says, you know, that the needs of the world play an integral role in our own awakening as to who we are, where our blind spots are, and so forth. So I'm going to go into looking at race with that perspective, but I want to, before doing that, talk about some ways to approach it. And, you know, we'll be taking 2 weeks with the theme, and I'll be giving some homework at the end of my talk, some things to look at. But I wanted to give somewhat of a framework just to help us to go into this theme as skillfully as possible. You know, I'm bringing together some of what I have found most helpful, sort of some assumptions and some recognitions. One of them is that, in my experience, a lot of the tools that we have been developing, such as mindfulness, compassion, working with difficult emotions, developing wisdom about our own grasping and fear, are necessary tools for looking into race and racism. And there's a lot that we have to offer, in using these tools. A lot of what I'll be inviting us to do is simply to track your minds in the next week. Where does your mind go? When do you notice yourself forming an other? You know, when do you notice a difference between you and someone in another category? You know, which could be race, could be gender, could be sexual orientation, could be age, could be all of these. So these tools are very, very crucial. Another very important understanding that I think is very helpful for going into this territory is that there are multiple dimensions of oppression. And all of us are at some times oppressed and at some times oppressors. That's not to say we're all equal. Some of us, you know, if we mention the cat, you know, we can think of multiple hierarchies in the society, with people in the, as it were, at the bottom or the lower half of the hierarchy receiving unequal treatment or negative treatment in some way. And we can think of multiple categories. We can think of course, race, but also gender, sexual orientation, religion, class, educational level. What are some other ones I've left out? What?
Physical ability.
And so forth. We could fill that out. There probably, you know, we probably could list 10 or 15 of those. And it's very helpful to know that these are all strong. Some of them obviously are more intense than others, right? You know, and the level of suffering or oppression is, they're not all equal in that way. But I find it very helpful to know that all of us either have been or will be treated unfairly and unequally because of membership in that category. All of us, if we get to be older, are treated in a certain way. You know, I think age is one of the last remaining civil rights movements to develop. A lot of people think with the baby boomers it'll finally happen because they'll say, I am really pissed off at how I'm being treated as a 75-year-old, 80-year-old, or whatever. Anyway, but I think that framework's very helpful because what it means is that there's not what's sometimes called, not a need to think of oneself as only oppressed or only oppressing. And that understanding is very helpful. I found in trainings I've been part of to understand that gives some freedom for actually going into one of the territories with a little more freedom. Because you know, we can know that we're not, you know, in the instance of race, for example, as people called white, we're not being, this is not the entirety of our identity. And there are places where white people have and will be oppressed in certain ways, right? And so I think that's an important understanding, you know, and in the trainings that I most respect, that understanding is really firmly established near the beginning. So it means that you can say, okay, well, let's go into race. That's part of my identity, but I can go into it a little more freely because I'm not going to be nailed as a bad person, right? Because there are multiple aspects. And maybe in this aspect, I'm on the privileged end, right? If one is white. But in other areas, I'm not. Right? So it's not the entirety of my identity. So that I find is helpful. Does that make some sense? Mm-hmm. Just to remember that gives freedom to actually go into this as much as possible without guilt and shame and blame and self-judgment. Because those emotions can come up very strongly in this territory. I think, as we know, you know, a phrase I sometimes use is when we look at the conditioning, we are not to blame for our conditioning, but we are responsible for it. Do you know that distinction? Mm-hmm. In other words, we have all been conditioned into systems which arose a long time ago, way before we were born. And there's certain conditioning we've received. We didn't ask for it. We may disagree with it, wish it didn't happen, but it did. But we can use that as a starting point for learning and transformation. And we want to really watch out in inquiring to this for the emotions of guilt and shame, self-judgment, as well as what comes up in terms of just levels of anger and pain. And maybe just to say one other thing, this is a very challenging area because a lot of the conditioning around race and racism is unconscious. A lot of researchers have been showing that now there's what people call implicit bias, which is operating at an unconscious level in the way our minds process information. And we've all had that experience, that the conditioning around race is not simply a matter of our conscious choice or what we say or what we do. That makes it trickier, right? And there are, again, a lot of social scientific studies have really shown this. You know, so, for example, they've shown that police officers, I think they showed this through research using video games, that police officers, when they use video games, they were more likely to shoot at black suspects with guns than white suspects with guns. I think the research is pretty well founded. They were able to really see that there were these implicit bias. They also found that, by the way, for black police officers. So it wasn't, you know, so black police officers could also take in the conditioning. It's very interesting, right? So, but they, you know, in test after test, they showed a lot of this is unconscious. I saw this most clearly, maybe most clearly the first time. When I was in my 20s, I was really interested in dreams. And I studied my dreams a lot. And over 2 years, I really got sometimes, I couldn't wait to go to sleep. Kind of opposite of the core Buddhist intention, you know. And I really got into it, and over about a year or 2 year period, I wrote down like 1,200 dreams, and I went back and analyzed them. One thing that was really fascinating was that I found that in my unconscious, black men were coded with danger. That when there was some fear in a situation, often a black man would arise in the dreams, right? And this was from someone who had a lot of experience with black people. When I was in college, I would play basketball all the time with young black men. So it didn't come out of lack of knowledge or lack of familiarity. And a lot of comfort on the surface, but it's deep in the unconscious, right? Question of clarification, maybe not a question of substance. One of substance may be saved for later. Yeah.
And that's obviously something I'm putting in.
Yeah, so a comment is the dog barks at black people but not at white people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So
a couple other.
Yeah, so this is the kind of we want to approach all of this as we would a meditation session. Mm-hmm. In other words, really just track what's there. And it takes a lot of honesty, and a lot of what we find is a little shocking, you know? Like what I described, I guess it's a little distant in time. I can feel okay, you know, be at rest with that, but it says a lot, right? And I don't take it personally. That's another key thing. We want to really investigate what we find in our minds, use our mindfulness, not take it personally, because it's just the system that we've been brought up in. And yet it's very important to investigate like that, right? And it can be shocking, you know, but you'll find with the most dedicated people, you know, you'll find something like this, including African Americans. You know, I remember Jesse Jackson once told the story of walking down a street, and it was at night, and he saw some men coming towards him. And he said at a certain point he was very glad that they were actually white men. He noticed his mind working like that. Or Desmond Tutu tells the story, you know, the South African archbishop, you know, dedicated opponent, major player in the fight against apartheid. He tells the story of being on an airplane and noticing there was a black pilot and feeling a little nervous, right? This is conditioning, right? And it's actually, I think for me, telling those stories helps to give some freedom just to look at what's there. That's what we want to do. We want to really look at what's there, watch any reactions, the guilt, the shame, but be able just to look in what's there. Nothing's going to change unless we do that. That's our basis for mindfulness practice, right? That'll be part of what I'll invite next week. So I wanted to also talk some about the general conditioning that's there, and give a little bit of a sense of the history about race, because I think for many of us we don't know the history. Let's see where these notes are. So the concept of race is relatively recent. I like to think that it came about at a certain period in history, roughly the end of the 1600s, and that it will end at a certain point in history. It's a conditioned phenomenon. Anicca vata sankhara upatava yadamino. All conditioned things are impermanent. They have the nature of arising and passing away. And so I do believe that. And that's, I think for me, it's a helpful perspective, that the conditioning around race and racism came into existence at a certain time, and it will disappear at a certain time. And in many ways, some aspects are weaker than it used to be. Of course, oppression is age-old, you know, and ways of one group oppressing another group are found in every society and are ancient. Doing it on the basis of race is just modern. You know, but you can look to all sorts of societies and find, you know, you can find slavery in other societies, you can find slavery in indigenous societies. I was sort of shocked when I went up to stay with indigenous communities in British Columbia to find that not very long ago, about 25% of the given population were slaves. I think they weren't treated like the slaves in the South, and they could actually enter into the community over time, but still there was a way they were slaves. And there, you know, different forms of oppression, different forms of distinction. You know, we have, even the time of the Buddha, we have the caste system, you know, in India. And of course, most of you know that the Buddha rejected the caste system within the Sangha. If you entered his community, one had to give up identity as a member of a particular caste. You know, and there's some, you know, maybe next time I'll read some, I'll take a little more time on that. There's some beautiful passages where the Buddha's, you know, famous and provocative, where he says, the true nature of a Brahmin, the highest caste, has to do with your mind, doesn't have to do with your birth. So he undermined the equivalent of the racial system of his time and said, in the community that we enter into here, that cannot exist. So that, you know, that's something to come back to, right? That was the starting point for all of his teaching, was basically saying the social norms of the existing society are not compatible with this practice. So I'm going to give a very brief and somewhat selective history, but it's useful to know that basically the concept of race arose in the late 1600s in the US when slaves first came to the U.S. in 1619 in Virginia. Remember that from high school history? No. I did. I remember. Anyway, 1619, slaves first brought to the U.S. in Virginia. And Virginia was really the place where a lot of things happened. But the system of slavery was not as strict as it would later become. In fact, slaves could become free in the Virginia of the period, basically up till the late 1600s. They could become free. They worked in the fields with indentured servants from Europe. There was no concept of white and black at that time. People were identified by either their religion or their place of origin. They were called Englishmen or Christians and so forth. And things were rather fluid. People worked together in the fields, as I mentioned. There was intermarriage. People could stop becoming slaves. In 1676, the African, much of the African population and the white workers joined together. There was a rebellion called Bacon's Rebellion. They joined together against the elites, the colonial elites. And this scared the elites tremendously. And so they started the typical divide and conquer process. And they started using the concept of race. Within 30 years, there were the first slave codes. They had the idea to have the working class whites be the buffer class between the Africans and the rulers. And they gave them certain privileges. They started slave patrols. The laws got made much more rigid. Slavery became a matter of inheritance. The laws became much more harsh. Slaves could be punished for all sorts of offenses. Someone could kill a slave after these laws, which hadn't existed before, without threat of punishment. And so things became much more hardened, much more quickened. They started using the concept of race. White workers were born as Englishmen, and they died as white people. The concept of white was created. You can see it was, again, according to the scholarship I've read, it was done as a form of social control. And of course, that's still being done, right? I think, at least again, my interpretation of a lot of what's happened in the last 30, 40 years is, again, the, in a way we could say, the white working class and some of the middle class being pawns, right, under, the so-called Reagan Democrats. Do you know that analysis? That they were, that there were, there was this backlash against the civil rights movement, and the politicians played to the racial fears, and the, the so-called Reagan Democrats started to choose racial, some sign that there'd be a racial backlash against the civil rights movement. This was especially in the form of drug laws, right? The drug laws of the 80s, the get tough on crime, all those, that was code, that was very well understood. And again, the kind of the white workers went against their own economic interests and advance their ability to be higher up in the racial hierarchy. Yeah. And that's when the drug laws were passed, that's when there was unequal, some of you probably know the analysis of Michelle Alexander, a book called The New Jim Crow, where she talks about how the mass incarceration on the basis of the drug laws, as I mentioned, often applied in very different ways, has resulted in large numbers of African Americans essentially being disenfranchised. That someone who is a felon cannot vote, cannot get a job, has difficulties with housing, and might even be driven to more crime and then go back in the system. And again, this has happened to 1/3 of African American men. So some similar dynamics now as we find at the origin. And so these slave codes were passed. With the coming of the new country, the racial codes were established. And one can find this particularly in the immigration laws. In 1790, right after the birth of the new country, there was the immigration laws, the naturalization laws were passed, which said that the only people who can go into the country, who can come into the country, are so-called free-born white people. People from African descent, people from Asian descent, were not permitted to come in and be citizens. And this was this was the law for a number of years. In fact, Asian immigrants were only permitted to become citizens in 1954. Native Americans only became citizens in 1924. People of African descent actually were able to be citizens after the Civil War. I don't know how many were coming in 1868, but that's when the laws were changed. That's interesting. But for, you know, that's things hardened, and there was a definition of only white people can really be citizens. So you can see there's a normative sense of whiteness developing. Now, that was the legal definition of whiteness, but socially, it was quite different. And so the history, as I've seen it, of whiteness actually changes a lot. And in the 19th century, some of the European groups were not seen by the mainstream as fully white. If you look in, you know, and these were particularly Irish, Italians, Eastern Europeans, they still could come in the country because they fit the legal definition of white, but the social account, they were not fully white. And so you have actually, if you look in the library of this material, you can find scholarly books on how the Irish became white. I have a book, How Jews Became White People. It happened around 1953. That's a little bit of a joke, but not so far off. You know, that I know the history. My father was not permitted to go to medical school because of being Jewish in 1948. You know, and that was very common. There were quota systems for Jews until the early 1960s. And as early, you know, as late as the 50s, I've heard there were signs in Sonoma County saying no Jews or Italians welcome. Right, so you find these, you know, you find whiteness also not so clear. You know, the categories are shifting. You know, and it was, you know, I was very, very interested once to see a study that showed that in Seattle area in the beginning of the 20th century, that you can find newspaper articles in which Swedish people are not really seen as white. Kind of, you know, popular stereotype, these are the blonde, you know, and so forth. But sure enough, they were seen, it was Anglo-Saxon, the mainstream, right? That was, and this shifted. And our current concept of white only has existed since the 1960s. It's interesting, right? So that gives you a sense that racial concepts are changing, you know, and it's very interesting. And so, similarly, concepts of blackness were changing. You know, in the origins of being black, to have any grandparent who was black made one black. Then it started changing, and in the after the Civil War in the South, the law became if you were had one fourth, if you had one grandparent who was black, you could have three white grandparents. You would still be black. And different states had different laws on blackness. So you could actually be white and go over the state border and become black. Right? And there were actually trials related to this where someone would, you know, sue to say, I'm white in this state, then why aren't I white in this state? So it got ridiculous, and it got to the point where some of the southern states adopted the so-called one-drop rule. You know that? Any ancestry whatsoever. Even if you are 31/32nd European background, you're black if you have one drop. So you can see the absurdity and get a sense, really, of the fear, you know, and the fear of this. So there's this, this is a little bit of the history, you know, I'm saying. And of course, we know that, you know, it's been probably most thick with African Americans have gone through the periods of slavery, which were, you know, I think it's very important to read more about that to get a sense of it. Truly horrendous, right? Truly horrendous. Some of you saw 12 Years a Slave, so you know some of the history. And, you know, then there was the period of Jim Crow, right? Which went up until the 1950s or so. And then the Civil Rights Movement, and then there's been somewhat of a retrenchment in the last 30 years. So we have that history. And it's why I think part of the way we inquire into this is actually to get to know the history better. Read the history, know what's happening, know what one's own conditioning is. And then the area that I wanted to particularly look at is to give briefly a series of questions, and then we'll come to our just a little bit of discussion time. That a lot of what is important, and what I'll encourage in the next week, if you can, I would encourage you to read some, and I'll give a reading list that I can post on the website that I have a brief reading list. If you have to read one book, one very nice book is called Waking Up White. It's a good starting point. Has a lot of great questions. This is to know some of the nature of whiteness. Now, some of you may have other ethnic backgrounds, and there are other very excellent materials, and I'll post some of those. Reading The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander is a very important book. You can read other, again, I'll list some of these in the reading list. So reading and becoming better informed about the realities is crucial. I found it helpful to actually look and ask a series of questions, like, when did you first become aware of your own racial identity or of another person's identity? Maybe just sit with that for a moment. What age were you? What experiences did you have? When did you become aware of the injustice related to racial divisions? What was your response? How old were you? How do you relate to your own ancestry? Do you know what your own ancestry is in a clear way? One of the findings that was most remarkable to me in this group, the six-month group at the East Bay Meditation Center, in which everyone in the group was identifying as a white person in some way, is that for most of the people, they didn't have a very clear sense of ancestry. A lot of them thought of themselves as mutts, and they didn't know their background. And there was a lot of suffering connected with that. They didn't know where they came from. They didn't have a clear sense. I would say two-thirds of the people in the group. It was surprising to me. It was really like a sense of, there's a sense of suffering in, you know, again, for people becoming white, to some extent it means I don't come from anywhere. You know. Now, that's not true for everyone, but it was true for a lot of these people. You know, they said, well, I have four ancestries. I don't really, you know, who am I? I don't know. And then just an invitation to track your own mind in the next week. See what comes up. See what comes up in being with people of different ethnicities. When you maybe respond to reading a newspaper. Notice your own mind working. And it may be a little bit harder. I don't know how many people have regular contact with someone from another ethnicity. And how many people do not? So those who do not, you may visit picturesque Berkeley or Oakland or San Francisco. Yeah. But watch your own minds, take notes, see what you find. Again, in the spirit of mindfulness, not blaming, but wanting to take responsibility for one's conditioning. And track your dreams also. Okay. So maybe I'll stop there and just open things up to any questions or comments, reflections. Next week I'm going to focus more on how do we respond. And this week I'm inviting more of an inner looking at what's there. And recognizing this is a huge area, I'm doing my best just to take us in a gradual way and invite some questions and some inquiry. So this next week inquiry, then next week when I come out, I'm going to deal a little bit more with how do we respond to all this, and a little more how we connect it with some aspects of Buddhist practice. So please, one and then two, please.
One of the things that comes up for me with having people be other,
yeah,
is when I can't understand them.
Yeah.
It's like a selected language. Very young people have it. Some people of color have it. Some other ethnicities. But I feel like they're other when I... And so I was hearing that there's a song in My Fair Lady, Why Can't They Learn to Speak, you know, his version of English.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a separator for me.
Yeah, so beautiful example, rich example, you know, example of noticing some barrier, sense of difference with certain kinds of language use. So what we'd want to look at is just, again, with this kind of no blame, no shame investigation, because it's probably going to be a mix of things, isn't it? You know, and you can see, am I creating an other? You know, in that creating of an other, am I better? You know, as in My Fair Lady, there was clearly a sense of better, right?
Well, the other thing is, are they creating the other? Are they keeping me out?
Yeah. Yeah, and just to watch where one's mind goes. Yeah.
No. I should apologize. This is kind of a wonky question. I was very interested in the historical exposition. I'd never thought of it that way. What do you think then about the British in India? Did they learn that from Americans? Did they pick up that habit? Because that was very rich.
The British in terms of, the British clearly thought of themselves as superior in India, but the caste system...
Clearly along racial lines.
I think the invasion of India was after that happened in Virginia.
Yes.
Historically. So yes. I think, I haven't read detailed accounts of what happened in Virginia. You know, how did they come up with it? I mean, I think there had been, you know... Although the concept of race was quite new, I think it had been used some in Europe, from what I've read, in the 1600s. So it was in the air some. But it, you know, again, the people that I've read on this and heard about it, clearly was an act of social control at that time in Virginia. Yeah, and India, I think it was part of the ethos. There was a sense of, particularly with the elites, apparently not as much with the working people. That's interesting, right? Because there was intermarriage, there was a lot of mixing before things got rigid. But the elites had different views, right? And they often had a sense of the superiority of the European culture. You know, and that certainly was very pronounced in India. Yeah. I think you had one. Did you?
Yeah.
And then,
I have a couple things.
I feel like a lot of times when I see someone of a different race, especially African Americans, I remember what they have been through and what how atrocious it must have been to be pulled from their families for no reason other than human greed, white people's greed, and brutalized and maimed and killed and tortured. And I think that when I see them struggling, there's so much struggle. You know, even here in Marin, we separate them. They're in Marin City, and
yeah.
we're here.
Yeah.
And it just seems to me that when I see them, that's the first thing I think of is how we've degraded them and put them in a position where they're lesser, and it's our fault. It's not their fault.
Yeah.
And that completely takes away any... It reminds me of the other, and it also makes me so angry and so
yeah.
Passionate about it that I want to give them a chance, you know, to
yeah.
give them a chance to repair their lives and
yeah.
have decent lives. And so that's what I think. And then I also think of all the richness that they brought to our culture, the music,
yeah.
and just everything that they bring that is so beautiful, and how we can degrade that because of the difference. You know, it's a shameful thing, and it's shameful that it's still happening. I don't need to tell you guys that, but that's how I try to get away from it, because you can't. Those tendencies are deep inside us to
yeah.
think of them as other. I'm Irish. My grandparents were hugely racist.
Yeah.
My aunts and uncles are still racist, and it's a blight. And then. The other thing, I don't know, I'm in tech, so I see the completely flip side of how we worship people from Asian cultures who have the ability to do things that are money-making and reward our system, and how if you're Asian and you're really good at being a coder, then that's a really great thing, you know? And I appreciate that, but it's still othering, you know? And then the third thing I was going to say really quickly was I read a Time... It was on the front of Time about 10 years ago, a picture of a woman who had all the features of all different races. And they said by the end of this century, everyone on the planet is going to look and have these... the race is not going to be an issue, because
mm-hmm.
we're going to be so blended. And in a way, that sucks, because the differences are great, but
mm-hmm.
if we can't get along, if we can't figure out how to get along, then maybe that's better. You know?
Yeah, so there's a lot in what you said. There's a lot of different aspects, but I think that that part of what's called for, I think, is what you were really bringing up at first. It's really the effort at empathy. You know, this is what our practice helps us develop, right? Empathy and compassion. Can I bring that to this situation? Yeah, you know, can I? You know, and it's sometimes it has to be actively chosen. It's not just waiting there in our daily lives as an obvious activity, right? So it could be, you know, to really connect, get to know people, and you know, and then maybe I'll talk more about trends, but I think right now 40% of American families have someone in their extended family from another ethnicity. 40%. I think probably heavily concentrated on the two coasts, I would think. And some people have said that that's actually a form of hope, because it connects people with empathy more quickly. You know, and I have found this in meeting with people when they say, well, yeah, we have, my daughter is married to a Latino man, and something gets awakened in the heart, right? Because basically what happens with this othering and the race, it's a closing down of the heart. That's what we're talking about. We're a closing down of the heart and mind, and a loss of access to our deeper nature. That's what this is all about. Maybe I'm going to take just one more, but maybe one other point I wanted to bring out was that part of what was very interesting with this East Bay Meditation Center group, we spent a lot of time looking at the nature of the white self and what are the manifestations. And one of the main manifestations of the white self is the good white self. So we want to look out for that. I want to be the good white self, right? And we all have that in our tendencies, right? So look out for that when you're tracking, if you're white, and there would be a counterpart if you're not. So maybe one more, and then we'll finish. Yeah.
I guess I don't
believe in the melting pot thing.
Yeah.
I do believe that people have to really very consciously deal with the difference. And I think about, actually, we've thought about this a lot in my practice. So
yeah.
It's a real conflicted kind of peace that you have with yourself, because there's some things that are very hard to accept, and just to try to even understand and recognize that they're there can be kind of shocking. And,
that's right.
But this conflicted peace, sometimes when I talk with other people, that's how I feel that they're feeling in the practice a lot of times.
Yeah, there are a lot of difficult emotions, a lot of conflicts, and it's hard to look into because for many of us, aren't we busy? Isn't it hard enough just to complete your to-do list without adding, you know, transform racism to your to-do list? And so I'm afraid because of time, I'm just going to have to... Can you hold it till next week? We'll give you first time next week. Okay, let's go with the... So let me just finish by saying my invitation would be to bring this to the fore each day of the week, maybe at the beginning of the day, set the intention to track your own experience, track your mind, maybe make a commitment to do a little bit of reading on this, in this area. That'd be my suggestion. And to try to just keep your own investigation alive in this area, then we would come back and compare notes next week. But it's a hard area to look into. Sometimes it would, you know, we had talked about maybe doing an all-day workshop to go into more depth, you know.